Isabella, what do you mean? Can you really be in love with James?
Do not pretend you had not guessed it before. You saw it in my every look and action. Yesterday I received his delightful confession of an equal love. My heart and faith alike are engaged to James.
Never had Catherine listened to anything so full of interest, wonder and joy. Her brother and her friend engaged. New to such circumstances, the importance of it appeared unspeakably great, and she contemplated it as one of those grand events of which the ordinary course of life can hardly afford a return. The strength of her feelings she could not express. The nature of them, however, contented her friend. The happiness of having such a sister was their first effusion, and the fair ladies mingled in embraces and tears of joy. Delighting, however, as Catherine sincerely did in the prospect of the connection, it must be acknowledged that Isabella far surpassed her in tender anticipations.
Oh, I feel that I shall be so much more attached to my dear Morland's family than to my own.
Oh!
You are so like your dear brother that I quite doted on you the first moment I saw you. But so it always is with me. The first moment settles everything. The very first day that Morland came to us last Christmas, the very first moment I saw James, my heart was irrevocably gone.
I suppose that is the power of love.
Your brother is this moment preparing to set off with all speed to Fullerton to make known his situation and ask consent from your parents. I am so agitated at the thought of what they shall say. I cannot bear it.
Oh, you must not be anxious, dear Isabella. There are no parents more kind or more desirous of their children's happiness than ours. I have no doubt of their consenting immediately.
Morland says exactly the same, and yet I dare not expect it. My fortune will be so small, they never can consent to it. Your brother, who might marry anybody.
Indeed, Isabella, you are too humble. The difference of fortune can signify to nothing.
My sweet Catherine, in your generous heart, I know it would signify nothing, but there are many in the world who are not as kind as you.
My dear Isabella, you have the strength of a heroine. I am sure our parents will consent. I am sure they will be delighted with you.
For my own part, my wishes are so moderate that the smallest income would be enough for me. I detest grandeur. I would not settle in London for the universe. A cottage in some retired village would be ecstasy. There are some charming little villas in Richmond.
Richmond? Oh, you must settle near Fullerton. Oh, you must be near us.
I'm sure I shall be miserable if we do not. But this is idle talking. I will not allow myself to think of such things till we have your father's answer. James says that by sending his letter tonight to Salisbury, I may have it tomorrow. Tomorrow? I shall never have the courage to open the letter. I know it will be the death of me. There is no use in our idle talk. But I do know the most delightful dressmaker who can make my wedding gown.
I cannot speak my happiness, Isabella.
The two friends, with hearts now more united than ever, were inseparable for the day, and in schemes of sisterly happiness the hours flew along. Mrs. Thorpe and her son, who were allowed to join the councils, seemed only to want Mr. Morland's consent. They would then consider Isabella's engagement as the most fortunate circumstance imaginable for their family. They soon added their quota of significant looks and mysterious expressions to fill up the measure of curiosity to be raised in the unprivileged younger sisters. To Catherine's simple feelings, this odd sort of reserve seemed unkind, but Anna Maria soon set her heart at ease by the sagacity of their I-know-what, and the evening was spent in a sort of war of wit, a display of family ingenuity, on one side in the mystery of an affected secret and on the other of undefined discovery, all equally acute. Catherine was with her friend again the next day, endeavouring to support her spirits and while away the many tedious hours before the delivery of the letters. Despite Catherine's presence, as well as that of Isabella's mother and brother, she became more and more desponding, and before the letter arrived, had worked herself into a state of real distress.
Positive answer cannot take this long. I am sure of it.
Mother, you are so dashed useless at cards. Why do you even play?
Oh, for my nerves, John. I cannot wait unoccupied on a morning such as this.
Oh, can it be the post? Catherine, look out of the window for me.
It is the post.
I cannot bear it. You must read the letter for me.
A letter for you, Miss Thorpe.
Oh, thank you. I shall take it for Miss Thorpe.
I must read it myself, Catherine. I must. Sit here beside me. I have had no difficulty in gaining the consent of my kind parents, and am promised that everything in their power shall be done to forward my happiness.
Oh, Isabella!
Mother, I am to be married.
Oh, dear, dear Isabella. Oh, dear, dear Catherine.
Well done, I say. Mr. Morland is one of the finest fellows in the world. I would not choose another man for you, Isabella. There is not one I should choose over him.
The letter, whence sprang all this felicity, was short, containing little more than this assurance of success, and every particular was deferred till James could write again. But for particulars, Isabella could well afford to wait. The needful was comprised in Mr. Morland's promise. His honour was pledged to make everything easy, and by what means their income was to be formed, whether landed property were to be resigned or funded money made over, was a matter in which her disinterested spirit took no concern. She knew enough to feel secure of an honourable and speedy establishment, and her imagination took a rapid flight over its attendant felicities. She saw herself at the end of a few weeks the gaze and admiration of every new acquaintance at Fullerton, the envy of every valued old friend in Putney, with a carriage at her command, a new name on her tickets, and a brilliant exhibition of hoop rings on her finger. When the contents of the letter were ascertained, John Thorpe, who had only waited its arrival to begin his journey to London, prepared to set off.
Miss Morland, I am glad to have found you alone for a moment. I must bid you goodbye.
I wish you a good journey.
Shall not you be late at Devizes, Mr. Thorpe?
A famous good thing, this marrying scheme, upon my soul. A clever fancy of Morland's and Bell's. And what do you think of it, Miss Morland? I say it's no bad notion.
I am sure I think it a very good one.
Do you? That's honest, by heavens. I am glad you are no enemy of matrimony, however. Did you ever hear the old song, going to one wedding brings on another? I say you will come to Belle's wedding, I hope.
Yes, I have promised your sister to be with her, if possible.
And then you know, I say, then you know we may try the truth of this same old song.
May we? But I never sing. Well, I wish you a good journey. I dine with Miss Tilney today and must now be going home.
Nay, but there is no such confounded hurry. Who knows when we may be together again? Not that I shall be down again by the end of a fortnight, and a devilish long fortnight it will appear to me.
Then why do you stay away for so long?
That is kind of you. Kind and good-natured. I shall not forget it in a hurry. But you have more good nature and all that than anybody living, I believe. A monstrous deal of good nature, and it's not only good nature, you have so much more. So much of everything. And then you have so much. Upon my soul, I do not know anybody like you.
Oh, dear. Well, there are a great many people like me, I dare say. Only a great deal better. Good morning to you.
But I say, Miss Morland, I shall come and pay my respects at Fullerton before it is too long. If it is not disagreeable.
Pray, do. My father and mother will be very glad to see you.
And I hope, Miss Morland, you will not be sorry to see me.
Oh dear, not at all. There are very few people I am sorry to see. Company is always cheerful.
That is just my way of thinking. Give me but a little cheerful company. Let me only have the company of the people I love. Let me only be where I like and be with whom I like. And the devil take the rest, say I. I'm heartily glad to hear you say the same, but I have a notion, Miss Morland, you and I think pretty much alike upon most matters.
Perhaps we may, but it is more than I ever thought of. And as to most matters, to say the truth, there are not many that I know my own mind about.
By Jove, no more do I. It is not my way to bother my brains with what does not concern me. My notion of things is simple enough. Let me only have the girl I like, say I, with a comfortable house over my head, and what care I for all the rest? Fortune is nothing. I am sure of a good income of my own, and if she had not a penny, why, so much the better.
Very true. I think like you there. If there is a good fortune on one side, there can be no occasion for any on the other, no matter which has it, so that there is enough. I hate the idea of one great fortune looking out for another, and to marry for money, I think the wickedest thing in existence. Good day, Mr. Thorpe. We shall be very glad to see you at Fullerton, whenever it is convenient.
there you are, Catherine. How was your morning with Miss
Mr.
Thorpe?
Allen, Mrs. Allen, I will sit down to tell you all of it.
I hope it is nothing grave.
Oh, no, quite the opposite. I could not speak of it until now because I knew nothing of it until yesterday. And even then, it was so uncertain. I have never known such a great event, nor such felicity for other people's lives. I learned yesterday that my brother and Miss Thorpe have admired one another ever since he came to Bath.
You learned that yesterday. My dear, we've known it since they first met one another.
I had no notion of it.
Their admiration follows from their meeting just as surely as they are now.
My dear, let Catherine tell us her news.
James and Isabella are in love. The day before yesterday, when the party went to Clifton, Isabella found her affections, which she insists I knew all about, were returned by James. Yesterday, my brother returned to Fullerton to ask my parents if they consent for him to marry Isabella. And they have granted it. James and Isabella are engaged.
I hope they are both very happy. Isabella is a beautiful girl.
And one with great good luck. Your brother is a fine young man. Only I wish I'd known of James going to Fullerton yesterday. I could have sent my best regards to your father and mother and to the Skinners. Shall we send for some tea?
Tea?
It is that time of the morning.
Oh, yes, I suppose it is.
Catherine's expectations of pleasure from her visit in Milsom Street that evening were so very high that disappointment was inevitable. Accordingly, though she was most politely received by General Tilney and kindly welcomed by his daughter, though Henry was at home, she found on her return, without spending many hours in the examination of her feelings, that she had gone to her appointment preparing for happiness which it had not afforded. Instead of finding herself improved in acquaintance with Miss Tilney from the intercourse of the day, she seemed hardly so intimate with her as before. Instead of seeing Henry Tilney to greater advantage than ever in the ease of a family party, he had never said so little, nor been so little agreeable, and in spite of their father's great civilities to her, it had been a release to get away from him. It puzzled her to account for all this. It could not be General Tilney's fault. That he was perfectly agreeable and good-natured and altogether a very charming man did not admit of a doubt, for he was tall and handsome and Henry's father. He could not be accountable for his children's want of spirits. She therefore hoped it might simply have been accidental. As for her want of enjoyment in his company, she could only attribute it to her own stupidity. Isabella, on hearing the particulars of the visit, gave a different explanation.
My dear Catherine, how insufferable! What an insolent family! And as to Miss Tilney, to behave to you in such a disagreeable way, hardly even to speak to you.
But it was not so bad as that, Isabella. There was no superciliousness. She was very civil.
Oh, don't defend her. And then the brother, he who had appeared so attached to you, good heavens! And so he hardly looked once at you the whole day?
I did not say so, but he did not seem in good spirits.
How contemptible! You must never think of him again, my dear Catherine. He is unworthy of you.
Unworthy? I do not suppose he ever thinks of me.
That is exactly what I say. He never thinks of you. Such fickleness! Oh, how different to your brother and to mine. I really believe John has the most constant heart.
But as for General Tilney, I assure you it would be impossible for anybody to behave to me with greater civility and attention. It seemed to be his only care to entertain and make me happy.
I believe he is a gentleman. John thinks very well of him.
Well, I shall see how they behave to me this evening. We shall meet them at the rooms.
And must I go?
Do not you intend it? I thought it was all settled.
Nay, I can refuse you nothing. But do not insist upon my being very agreeable, for my heart will be some 40 miles off. And as for dancing, do not mention it, I beg. It is quite out of the question. I shall be thinking only of James.
Isabella's opinion of the Tilneys did not influence Catherine. She was sure there had been no insolence in the manners either of brother or sister, and she did not credit there being any pride in their hearts. The evening rewarded her confidence. She was met by one with the same kindness and by the other with the same attention as heretofore. Miss Tilney took pains to be near her, and Henry asked her to dance. Having heard the day before in Milsom Street that their elder brother, Captain Tilney, was expected almost every hour, she was at no loss for the name of a very fashionable-looking, handsome young man whom she had never seen before and who now evidently belonged to their party. She looked at him with great admiration and even supposed it possible that some people might think him handsomer than his brother, though in her eyes his air was more assuming and his countenance less prepossessing. His taste and manners were beyond a doubt decidedly inferior, for within her hearing he not only protested against every thought of dancing himself, but even laughed openly at Henry for finding it possible. From the latter circumstance it may be presumed that whatever might be our heroine's opinion of him, his admiration of her was not of a very dangerous kind, not likely to produce animosities between the brothers, nor persecutions to the lady. He cannot be the instigator of the three villains in horsemen's greatcoats, by whom she will hereafter be forced into a travelling chaise and four, which will drive off with incredible speed. Catherine, meanwhile, undisturbed by presentiments of such an evil, enjoyed her usual happiness with Henry Tilney, dancing and talking, listening with sparkling eyes to everything he said, and, in finding him irresistible, becoming so herself.
You have a very lively spirit when you dance this morning.
Thank you.
Here comes my brother. I can introduce you properly. Miss Morland, may I introduce Captain Tilney?
A pleasure to meet you, Miss Morland. Brother, might I speak with you a moment?
Excuse me, Miss Morland. I shall return in just a moment. Forgive me, Miss Morland. Do you think your friend, Miss Thorpe, would have any objection to dancing? My brother would be most happy to be introduced to her.
I'm very sure Miss Thorpe does not mean to dance at all.
Then I take my leave. Good evening.
Your brother will not mind it, I know, because I heard him say before that he hated dancing. But it was very good-natured of him to think of it. I suppose he saw Isabella sitting down and fancied that she might wish for a partner. But he is quite mistaken, for she would not dance upon any account in the world. She told me so this afternoon.
How very little trouble it can give you to understand the motive of other people's actions.
Why? What do you mean?
With you, it is not how is such a one likely to be influenced. What is the inducement most likely to act upon such a person's feelings if age, situation, and probable habits of life are considered? But how should I be influenced? What would be my inducement in acting so-and-so?
I do not understand you.
Then we are on very unequal terms, for I understand you perfectly well.
Me? Yes. I cannot speak well enough to be unintelligible.
Bravo. An excellent satire on modern language.
But pray, tell me what you mean.
Shall I indeed? Do you really desire it, but you are not aware of the consequences? It would involve you in a very cruel embarrassment and certainly bring on a disagreement between us.
No, no. It shall not do either. I am not afraid.
Well, then. I only meant that you're attributing my brother's wish of dancing with Miss Thorpe to good nature alone. Convince me of your being superior in good nature yourself to all the rest of the world.
Catherine blushed and disclaimed, and the gentleman's predictions were verified. There was a something, however, in his words which repaid her for the pain of confusion, and that something occupied her mind so much that she drew back for some time, forgetting to speak or to listen, and almost forgetting where she was, till, roused by the voice of Isabella, she looked up and saw her with Captain Tilney preparing to give them hands across. Isabella shrugged her shoulders and smiled. The only explanation of this extraordinary change which could at that time be given. But as it was not quite enough for Catherine's comprehension, she spoke her astonishment in very plain terms to her partner.
I cannot think how it could happen. Isabella was so determined not to dance.
And did Isabella never change her mind before?
Oh, but because... And your brother, after what you told him from me, how could he think of going to ask her?
I cannot take surprise to myself on that head. You bid me be surprised on your friend's account, and therefore I am. But as for my brother, his conduct in the business, I must own, has been no more than I believed him perfectly equal to. The fairness of your friend was an open attraction. Her firmness, you know, could only be understood by yourself.
You are laughing, but I assure you, Isabella is very firm in general.
It is as much as should be said of anyone. To be always firm is to be often obstinate. When properly to relax is the thing. And, my brother aside, I think Miss Thorpe has not chosen ill in fixing on the present hour.
The friends were not able to get together for any confidential discourse till all the dancing was over. But then, as they walked about the room arm in arm, Isabella thus explained herself.
I do not wonder at your surprise, and I am really fatigued to death. He is such a rattle. Amusing enough, but I would have given the world to sit still.
Then why did not you?
Oh, my dear. I refused him as long as I possibly could, but he would take no denial. You have no idea how he pressed me. I begged him to excuse me and get some other partner, but no, he wanted to be with me. Oh, such nonsense. So then I found there would be no peace if I did not stand up. And I am sure your dear brother would have been miserable if I had sat down the whole evening. My spirits are quite jaded. Captain Tilney is such a smart young fellow. I saw every eye was upon us.
He is very handsome indeed.
Handsome? Yes, I suppose he is. But he is not at all in my style of beauty. Amazingly conceited, I am sure. I took him down several times, you know, in my way.
When the young ladies next met, they had a far more interesting subject to discuss. James Morland's second letter was then received, and the kind intentions of his father fully explained. A living, of which Mr. Morland was himself patron and incumbent, of about £400 yearly value, was to be resigned to his son as soon as he should be old enough to take it. No trifling deduction from the family income, no niggardly assignment to one of 10 children. An estate of at least equal value, moreover, was assured as his future inheritance. James expressed himself on the occasion with becoming gratitude, and the necessity of waiting between 2 and 3 years before they could marry, being, however unwelcome, no more than he had expected, was borne by him without discontent. Catherine, whose expectations had been as unfixed as her ideas of her father's income, and whose judgment was now entirely led by her brother, felt equally well satisfied and heartily congratulated Isabella.
I am delighted all is so pleasantly settled.
It is very charming indeed. Mamma, do you not think so?
Mr. Morland has behaved vastly handsome indeed. I only wish I could do as much. One could not expect more from him, you know. If he finds he can do more by and by, I dare say he will, for I am sure he must be an excellent good-hearted man. 400 is but a small income to begin on, indeed. But your wishes, my dear Isabella, are so moderate. You do not consider how little you ever want, my dear.
It is not on my own account I wish for more. But I cannot bear to be the means of injuring my dear Morland, making him sit down upon an income hardly enough to live by. For myself, it is nothing. I never think of myself.
I know you never do, my dear, and you will always find your reward in the affection it makes everybody feel for you. There was never a young woman so beloved as you by everybody that knows you. And I dare say when Mr. Morland sees you, my dear child... But do not let us distress our dear Catherine by talking of such things. Mr. Morland has behaved so very handsome, you know. I always heard he was a most excellent man. And you know, my dear, we are not to suppose that if you had had a suitable fortune, he would have come down with something more. For I am sure he must be a most liberal-minded man.
Nobody can think better of Mr. Morland than I do, Mamma. But everybody has their failing, you know, and everybody has a right to do what they like with their own money.
I am sure that my father has promised to do as much as he can afford.
As to that, my sweet Catherine, there cannot be a doubt. And you know me well enough to be sure that a much smaller income would satisfy me. It is not the want of more money that makes me just at present a little out of spirits. I hate money. And if our union could take place now upon only £50 a year, I should have not a wish unsatisfied. Ah, my Catherine, you found me out. There's the sting.
the long, long, endless 2 years and a half that had passed before your brother can hold the living.
Yes, yes, my darling Isabella, we perfectly see into your heart. You have no disguise. We perfectly understand the present vexation, and everybody must love you the better for such a noble, honest affection.
Catherine's uncomfortable feelings began to lessen. She endeavoured to believe that the delay of the marriage was the only source of Isabella's regret, and when she saw her at their next interview, as cheerful and amiable as ever, endeavoured to forget that she had for a minute thought otherwise. James soon followed his letter and was received with the most gratifying kindness. The Allens had now entered on the sixth week of their stay in Bath, and whether it should be the last was for some time a question to which Catherine listened with a beating heart. To have her acquaintance with the Tilneys end so soon was an evil which nothing could counterbalance. Her whole happiness seemed at stake while the affair was in suspense, and everything secured when it was determined that the lodgings should be taken for another fortnight. What this additional fortnight was to produce to her, beyond the pleasure of sometimes seeing Henry Tilney, made but a small part of Catherine's speculation. Once or twice, indeed, since James's engagement had taught her what could be done, she had got so far as to indulge in a secret, perhaps. But in general, the felicity of being with him for the present bounded her views. The present was now comprised in another 3 weeks, and her happiness being certain for that period, the rest of her life was at such a distance as to excite but little interest. In the course of the morning which saw this business arranged, she visited Miss Tilney and poured forth her joyful feelings.
Miss Tilney, I hope you do not mind my arriving without our having an engagement. I could not contain my news.
Would you sit down and tell me?
I have been filled with dread these last days. I feared that this week was to be Mr. Allen's last week in Bath, but it is not so. I learned only this morning that Mr. Allen is adding a fortnight to his stay. I am so glad that our acquaintance can be extended.
Miss Morland, I'm afraid my father's turn of mind is quite the opposite to Mr. Allen. He is just determined upon quitting Bath by the end of another week.
By the end of another week?
Yes, my father can seldom be prevailed on to give the waters what I think a fair trial. He has been disappointed of some friend's arrival whom he expected to meet here, and as he is now pretty well, is in a hurry to get home.
I am very sorry for it. If I had known this before...
But perhaps you would be so good, it would make me very happy if...
Good morning, Miss Morland. I hope you're well.
Good morning, General Tilney. Quite well, thank you.
Eleanor, may I congratulate you on being successful in your application to your fair friend?
I was just beginning to make the request, sir, as you came in.
Well... Proceed by all means. I know how much your heart is in it. My daughter, Miss Morland, has been forming a very bold wish. We leave Bath, as she has perhaps told you, on Saturday se'nnight. A letter from my steward tells me that my presence is wanted at home, and being disappointed in my hope of seeing the Marquis of Longtown and General Courtney here, some of my very old friends, there is nothing to detain me longer in Bath. And could we carry our selfish point with you... We should leave it without a single regret. Can you, in short, be prevailed on to quit this scene of public triumph and oblige your friend Eleanor with your company in Gloucestershire? I am almost ashamed to make this request, though its presumption would certainly appear greater to every creature in Bath than yourself, modesty such as yours. But not for the world would I pain it by open praise. If you can be induced to honour us with a visit, you will make us happy beyond expression. 'Tis true we can offer you nothing like the gaieties of this lively place. We can tempt you neither by amusement nor splendour, for our mode of living, as you see, is plain and unpretending. Yet no endeavours shall be wanting on our side to make Northanger Abbey not wholly disagreeable.
Northanger Abbey? I am most... Well, I cannot say how delighted I should be to visit. It is a most flattering invitation... I must ask Papa and Mama for their consent, of course, and Mr. and Mrs. Allen.
I must confess I have already waited on your excellent friends in Pulteney Street and obtained their sanction of my wishes.
Then we must wait only on my parents. I will write home directly. I dare say they will not object.
The circumstances of the morning had led Catherine's feelings through the varieties of suspense, security and disappointment, but they were now safely lodged in perfect bliss. And with spirits elated to rapture, with Henry at her heart and Northanger Abbey on her lips, she hurried home to write her letter.
Dearest Papa and Mama, I can hardly think how I am to search out the words for my felicity. I have been invited to stay with the Tilneys at their home, Northanger Abbey in Gloucestershire. I write to ask if you consent to my going. The Allens have already agreed. They think the Tilneys a most charming family and an excellent acquaintance. Send me your word as quickly as possible, that I may begin to truly know it is to happen. Imagine all the chances against me. Northanger might have been a house, hall, place, park, court or cottage, but it has turned up an abbey, and I will be its inhabitant. Its long, damp passages, its narrow cells and ruined chapel will be within my daily reach. I confess I hope for some traditional legends, some awful memorials of an injured and ill-fated nun. Your most affectionate, Catherine.
Dearest Catherine, we are delighted to hear of your news. We know there will be nothing more delightful to you than residing with your dear friends at such a place as Northanger. Of course we consent to your going. We rely on the discretion of the Allens and feel no doubt of the propriety of an acquaintance which has been formed under their eye. We wish you a very happy time. Only do not read too many books. Yours affectionately, Papa and Mama.
Her parents' indulgence, though not more than Catherine had hoped for, completed her conviction of being favoured beyond every other human creature in friends and fortune, circumstance and chance. Everything seemed to cooperate for her advantage. By the kindness of her first friends, the Allens, she had been introduced into scenes where pleasures of every kind had met her. Her feelings, her preferences had each known the happiness of a return. Wherever she felt attachment, she had been able to create it. The affection of Isabella was to be secured to her in a sister. The Tilneys, they by whom above all she desired to be favourably thought of, outstripped even her wishes in the flattering measures by which their intimacy was to be continued. She was to be their chosen visitor. She was to be for weeks under the same roof with the person whose society she mostly prized. And in addition to all the rest, this roof was to be the roof of an abbey. Her passion for ancient edifices was next in degree to her passion for Henry Tilney, and castles and abbeys made usually the charm of those reveries which his image did not fill. It was wonderful that her friends should seem so little elated by the possession of such a home as Northanger, that the consciousness of it should be so meekly borne. The power of early habit only could account for it. A distinction to which they had been born gave no pride. Their superiority of abode was no more to them than their superiority of person. With a mind thus full of happiness, Catherine was hardly aware that 2 or 3 days had passed away without her seeing Isabella for more than a few minutes together. She began first to be sensible of this and to sigh for her conversation as she walked along the pump room one morning by Mrs. Allen's side without anything to say or to hear. And scarcely had she felt a 5 minutes' longing of friendship before the object of it appeared and, inviting her to a secret conference, led the way to a bench between the doors, which commanded a tolerable view of everybody entering at either. Catherine, observing that Isabella's eyes were continually bent towards one door or another, as in eager expectation, and remembering how often she had been falsely accused of being arch, thought the present a fine opportunity for being really so, and therefore gaily said,
"Do not be uneasy, Isabella. James will soon be here."
"My dear creature, do not think me such a simpleton as to be always wanting to confine him to my elbow. It would be hideous to always be together. And so you are going to Northanger. It is one of the finest old places in England, I understand. I shall depend upon a most particular description of it."
"You shall certainly have the best in my power to give. But who are you looking for? Are your sisters coming?"
"Oh, I'm not looking for anybody. My thoughts are 100 miles off. I am amazingly absent. I believe I am the most absent creature in the world. Captain Tilney says it is always the case with minds of a certain stamp.
But I thought, Isabella, that you had something in particular to tell me.
Oh, yes, and so I have. Well, the thing is this. I have just had a letter from John. You can guess the contents.
No, indeed, I cannot.
My sweet love, do not pretend. What can he write about but yourself? You know he is over head and ears in love with you.
With me? Oh, dear Isabella.
My sweetest Catherine, you are being quite absurd. You are fishing for compliments. John's attentions to you were such as a child must have noticed. And it was but half an hour before he left Bath that you gave him the most positive encouragement. He says so in this letter. Says that he as good as made you an offer and that you received his advances in the kindest way. And now he wants me to urge his suit and say all manner of pretty things to you.
I have never had a single thought of Mr. Thorpe being in love with me. Well, how could I ever have intended to encourage him if I had no notion of his feelings? I do declare, upon my honour, I never was sensible of any attentions on his side for a moment, except just his asking me to dance the first day of his coming. And as to making me an offer, or anything like it, there must be some unaccountable mistake. I could not have misunderstood a thing of that kind, you know. And as I ever wish to be believed, I solemnly protest that no syllable of such a nature ever passed between us. The last half hour before he went away, it must be all and completely a mistake, for I did not see him once that whole morning.
But you certainly did, for you spent the whole morning in Edgar's buildings. It was the day your father's consent came, and I'm pretty sure that you and John were alone in the parlour some time before you left the house.
Are you? Well, if you say it, it was so, I dare say, but for the life of me, I cannot recollect it. I do remember now being with you and seeing him as well as the rest, but that we were ever alone for 5 minutes. Oh, however, it is not worth arguing about, for whatever might pass on his side, you must be convinced, by my having no recollection of it, that I never thought, nor expected, nor wished for anything of the kind from him. I am excessively concerned that he should have any regard for me, but indeed it has been quite unintentional on my side. I never had the smallest idea of it. Pray, undeceive him as soon as you can, and tell him I beg his pardon. That is, I do not know what I ought to say, but I'll make him understand what I mean in the properest way. I would not speak disrespectfully of a brother of yours, Isabella, I am sure. But you know very well that if I could think of one man more than another, he is not the person. My dear friend, you must not be angry with me. I cannot suppose your brother cares so very much about me. And, you know, we shall still be sisters.
Yes, yes. There are more ways than one of us being sisters. Well, my dear Catherine, the case seems to be that you are determined against poor John. Is not it so?
I certainly cannot return his affection, and as certainly never meant to encourage it.
Since that is the case, I am sure I shall not tease you any further. John desired me to speak to you on the subject, and therefore I have. But I confess, as soon as I read his letter, I thought it a very foolish, imprudent business, and not likely to promote the good of either.
You do acquit me, then, of anything wrong? You are convinced that I never meant to deceive your brother, never suspected him of liking me till this moment.
As to that, I do not pretend to determine what your thoughts and designs in time past may have been. All that is best known to yourself. But you may be assured that I am the last person in the world to judge you severely. What one means one day, one may not mean the next. Circumstances change, opinions alter.
But my opinion of your brother never did alter. It was always the same. You are describing what never happened.
My dearest Catherine, nothing would justify me in wishing you to sacrifice all your happiness merely to oblige my brother. He would perhaps, after all, be just as happy without you. What I say is, why should a brother's happiness be dearer to me than a friend's? You know I carry my notions of friendship pretty high. And above all things, my dear Catherine, do not be in a hurry. Take my word for it, that if you're in too great a hurry, you will certainly live to repent it. Captain Tilney says there is nothing people are so often deceived in as the state of their own affections, and I believe he is right. Ah, here he comes. Never mind, he will not see us, I am sure.
Catherine, looking up, perceived Captain Tilney. And Isabella, earnestly fixing her eye on him as she spoke, soon caught his notice. He approached immediately and took the seat to which her movements invited him. His first address made Catherine start. Though spoken low, she could distinguish.
What? Always to be watched? In person or by proxy?
Psst, nonsense. Why do you put such things into my head, if I could believe it? My spirit, you know, is pretty independent.
I wish your heart were independent. That would be enough for me.
My heart indeed. What can you have to do with hearts? You men have none of you any hearts.
If we have not hearts, we have eyes. And they give us torment enough.
Do they? I'm sorry for it. I'm sorry they find anything so disagreeable in me. I will look another way. I hope this pleases you. I hope your eyes are not tormented now.
Never more so. For the edge of a blooming cheek is still in view. At once too much and too little.
Isabella, I should join Mrs. Allen. Will you walk with me?
Oh, no. I'm so amazingly tired. And it is so odious to parade about the pump room. And if I move from my seat, I should miss my sisters. I'm expecting my sisters every moment. My dearest Catherine, you must excuse me.
Oh, there is Mrs. Allen now. I expect we shall return home soon. Good day, Isabella. Captain Tilney.
With much uneasiness did she thus leave them. It seemed to her that Captain Tilney was falling in love with Isabella, and Isabella unconsciously encouraging him. Unconsciously it must be, for Isabella's attachment to James was as certain and well acknowledged as her engagement. To doubt her truth or good intentions was impossible, and yet she wished Isabella had talked more like her usual self and not so much about money, and had not looked so well pleased at the sight of Captain Tilney. How strange that she should not perceive his admiration. Catherine longed to give her a hint of it, to put her on her guard and prevent all the pain which her too lively behaviour might otherwise create both for him and her brother. A few days passed away, and Catherine, though not allowing herself to suspect her friend, could not help watching her closely. The result of her observations was not agreeable. Isabella seemed an altered creature. When Catherine saw her surrounded only by their immediate friends in Edgar's Buildings or Pulteney Street, her change of manners was trifling. Only something of languid indifference, or of that boasted absence of mind, which Catherine had never heard of before, would occasionally come across her. But when in public, admitting Captain Tilney's attentions as readily as they were offered, and allowing him almost an equal share with James in her notice and smiles, the alteration became too positive to be passed over. What could be meant by such unsteady conduct? What her friend could be at was beyond her comprehension. Isabella could not be aware of the pain she was inflicting, but it was a degree of wilful thoughtlessness which Catherine could not but resent. James was the sufferer. She saw him grave and uneasy, and for poor Captain Tilney, too, she was greatly concerned. Though his looks did not please her, his name was a passport to her goodwill, and she thought with sincere compassion of his approaching disappointment, for his behaviour was so incompatible with a knowledge of Isabella's engagement that she could not, upon reflection, imagine him aware of it. She wished, by a gentle remonstrance, to remind Isabella of her situation, but both opportunity and comprehension were always against her. If able to suggest a hint, Isabella could never understand it. In this distress, the intended departure of the Tilney family became her chief consolation. Their journey into Gloucestershire was to take place within a few days, and Captain Tilney's removal would at least restore peace to every heart but his own. But Captain Tilney had at present no intention of removing. He was to continue at Bath. When Catherine knew this, her resolution was directly made. She spoke to Henry Tilney on the subject.
I shall speak plainly, Mr. Tilney. I regret your brother's evident partiality for Miss Thorpe. I do not believe he should remain in Bath, in her company, under the deception that her heart is free. I can only ask that you please make known to him her prior engagement.
My brother does know it.
Does he? Then why does he stay here? Why do not you persuade him to go away? The longer he stays, the worse it will be for him at last. Oh, pray advise him for his own sake, and for everybody's sake,
to leave Bath directly. Absence will in time make him comfortable again, but he can have no hope here, and it is only staying to be miserable.
I am sure my brother would not wish to do that.
Then you will persuade him to go away.
Persuasion is not at command. But pardon me if I cannot even endeavour to persuade him. I have myself told him that Miss Thorpe is engaged. He knows what he is about and must be his own master.
No, he does not know what he is about. He does not know the pain he is giving my brother. Not that James has ever told me so, but I am sure he is very uncomfortable.
And are you sure it is my brother's doing?
Yes, very sure.
Is it my brother's attentions to Miss Thorpe or Miss Thorpe's admission of them that gives the pain?
Is not it the same thing?
I think Mr. Morland would acknowledge a difference. No man is offended by another man's admiration of the woman he loves. It is the woman only who can make it a torment.
Isabella is wrong, but I am sure she cannot mean to torment, for she is very much attached to my brother. She has been in love with him ever since they first met, and while my father's consent was uncertain, she fretted herself almost into a fever. You know she must be attached to him.
I understand. She is in love with James and flirts with Frederick.
Oh, no, not flirts. A woman in love with one man cannot flirt with another.
It is probable that she will neither love so well nor flirt so well as she might do either singly. The gentlemen must each give up a little.
Then you do not believe Isabella so much attached to my brother?
I can have no opinion on the subject.
But what can your brother mean? If he knows her engagement, what can he mean by his behaviour?
You are a very close questioner.
Am I? I only ask what I want to be told.
But do you only ask what I can be expected to tell?
Well, yes, I think so, for you must know your brother's heart.
My brother's heart, as you term it, I can only guess at on the present occasion, I assure you.
Well?
Nay, if it is to be guesswork, let us all guess for ourselves. To be guided by second-hand conjecture is pitiful. The premises are before you. My brother is a lively and perhaps sometimes a thoughtless young man. He has had about a week's acquaintance with your friend, and he has known her engagement almost as long as he has known her.
Well, you may be able to guess at your brother's intentions from all this, but I am sure I cannot. But is not your father uncomfortable about it? Does not he want Captain Tilney to go away? Sure, if your father were to speak to him, he would go.
My dear Miss Morland, in this amiable solicitude for your brother's comfort, may you not be a little mistaken? Are you not carried a little too far? Would he thank you either on his own account or Miss Thorpe's for supposing that her affection, or at least her good behaviour, is only to be secured by her seeing nothing of Captain Tilney? Is he safe only in solitude? Or is her heart constant to him only when unsolicited by anyone else? He cannot think this, and you may be sure that he would not have you think it. I will not say do not be uneasy, because I know that you are so at this moment. But be as little uneasy as you can. You have no doubt of the mutual attachment of your brother and your friend. Depend upon it, therefore, that real jealousy never can exist between them. Depend upon it that no disagreement between them can be of any duration. Their hearts are open to each other, as neither heart can be to you. They know exactly what is required and what can be borne, and you may be certain that one will never tease the other beyond what is known to be pleasant. Though Frederick does not leave Bath with us, he will probably remain but a very short time, perhaps only a few days behind us. His leave of absence will soon expire, and he must return to his regiment. And what will then be their acquaintance? The mess room will drink Isabella Thorpe for a fortnight, and she will laugh with your brother over poor Tilney's passion for a month.
Catherine would contend no longer against comfort. She had resisted its approaches during the whole length of a speech, but it now carried her captive. Henry Tilney must know best. She blamed herself for the extent of her fears and resolved never to think so seriously on the subject again. Her resolution was supported by Isabella's behaviour in their parting interview. The Thorpes spent the last evening of Catherine's stay in Pulteney Street, and nothing passed between the lovers to excite her uneasiness or make her quit them in apprehension. James was in excellent spirits and Isabella most engagingly placid. Her tenderness for her friend seemed rather the first feeling of her heart, but that at such a moment was allowable. And once she gave her lover a flat contradiction, and once she drew back her hand. But Catherine remembered Henry's instructions and placed it all to judicious affection. The embraces, tears, and promises of the parting fair ones may be fancied. Mr. and Mrs. Allen were sorry to lose their young friend, whose good humour and cheerfulness had made her a valuable companion. Her happiness in going with Miss Tilney, however, prevented their wishing it otherwise. Mr. Allen attended her to Milsom Street, where she was to breakfast, and saw her seated with the kindest welcome among her new friends. But so great was her agitation in finding herself as one of the family, and so fearful was she of not doing exactly what was right, and of not being able to preserve their good opinion, that in the embarrassment of the first 5 minutes, she could almost have wished to return with him to Pulteney Street. Miss Tilney's manners and Henry's smile soon did away some of her unpleasant feelings, but still she was far from being at ease, and nor could the incessant attentions of the General himself entirely reassure her. Nay, perverse as it seemed, she doubted whether she might not have felt less had she been less attended to.
Won't you please eat more, Miss Morland? Your breakfast could not satisfy a bird.
I have plenty. Thank you, General.
Do you find nothing to your taste?
No. Indeed, I have never seen half such variety on a breakfast table.
I cannot believe it. Perhaps you may take another plate in a little while. Shall I send for fresh tea?
No, thank you. I have a full cup.
Where is Frederick? Eleanor, have you seen him? Miss Morland, you must forgive my son being so late to breakfast. He has been called for several times. It is intolerably rude of him.
Not at all.
Here I am, Father. Forgive me, Miss Morland. I meant no offence by my late rising.
I could not possibly.
Late rising? It is almost 9:30. Your laziness is beyond excuse, Frederick. To appear not even half an hour before our departure is disrespectful beyond measure to Miss Morland. Keeping time is the simplest of disciplines. It is one a boy can master. Sit down beside your sister. Miss Morland, I hope the journey shall not be too tiresome for you. It is 30 miles to Northanger.
The bustle of going was not pleasant,